Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi guys, and welcome to Adulting. This is the podcast where I discover that actually we're not as grown up as we once thought that we were. And today I'm joined by Sophia Money-Coutts.
Hello.
Sophia is a journalist and author, and she has just published her first book.
Yes.
The Plus One.
The Plus One, yeah. It's out next week. And it's, The Plus One. It's about my very chaotic but hopefully lovable heroine, Polly, who has just turned 30 and is at that stage of life when all her mates are sort of 10 stages ahead of her in terms of relationships and babies and houses and blah, 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 work and promotions. And she's not. But she works for Posh Magazine, and then one day she gets invited to Yorkshire to interview this playboy son of a duke, and dun dun dun, it all unfolds from there.
It's amazing. I love Posh Magazine, because I just know you can just see so many parallels in it. It is really good, and it's hailed as like the new kind of Bridget Jones vibe, isn't it?
Yes, like, really gratifyingly, people have said that. A sort of cross between, I mean, it sounds very arrogant saying this, a sort of cross between Bridget Jones and Gilly Cooper.
Nice.
Is sort of the vibe, yeah. I think, which is lovely to hear. And Gilly, bless Gilly, gave me a quote for the front. I mean, I was quite intimidated. She said the sex in my book made her feel like a nun.
I love, because it comes in quite soon as well, because that far in. And I was sat with my boyfriend, and he was like, what have you just read? And it's the bit where...
Was it the scene when she brings Callum back?
Yeah, she brings him back.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh my God, I feel violated.
Oh no, God, sorry.
No, it's really well written, because it's really, because it is like you're there in the moment.
Well, what I really wanted the sex scenes to be realistic, and then not in a 50 Shades way, or in a sort of silly way, or in a too romantic a way. I just wanted them to be what women would be thinking.
Yeah.
So there's this scene, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but yeah, there's a scene where Polly comes back with someone, and she has to sort of give him a blowjob, and she's down there, and she's just like, oh, for God's sake, my legs are sore, and smells, and my thighs are burning, and how much longer? And I just really wanted other women to read that and be like, oh my God, that's so true.
Yeah, and I love the internal monologue that she's having as well, because that's my favourite thing, like the amount of things that you think about which have nothing to do with your boyfriend or whoever you're sleeping with at the time. You're just like, what is that? Have I put the washing on? And then you're like, oh, right, what's going on? Oh,
yeah, concentrate.
Which I really found that really funny. And I do think it's so important that we, in this sex positive time, are making sure that it is messy and wet and gross, and it's not
weird noises, and oh God, what's he doing now, and oh, actually that doesn't feel that nice, and oh no, stop it, that all that sort of thing. I just feel like,
have you had many men reading it and feeling shocked? Because I feel like they almost, obviously not a lot, but I feel like a broad spectrum of guys would read that and be shocked, because I generally think they even see sex in a pornified way in their own experience.
Yeah.
They kind of like impose that idea.
And they're like, oh, it's such an honour that you're down there.
Yeah.
Enjoy it.
Yeah.
Well, my boyfriend actually, I think, was quite sort of, he read it. He was like, oh. And actually, I wrote most of the book before we got together. But because Polly obviously is quite like me, I think first books, your heroine probably tends to be quite like you. Lloyd, my boyfriend, definitely read it thinking that I was Polly, and that he got quite annoyed. It was hilarious. He was annoyed that he got jealous. It was really sweet.
So funny.
And I was like, oh God, all this stuff that you're doing. And I was like, well, it's not me, is it? It's a fictional character. It's Polly. That was one reaction. My dad's reaction was quite interesting.
Did your dad read it? Yeah. Oh no, I couldn't cope.
Well, I'm very lucky. I've got a sort of very open family. So when we talk about sort of sex and stuff, it's fine. But dad reading that sort of blowjob scene and then repeating lines back to me. I remember in the car with him at one point and he was repeating lines back to me. And you know in Ladybird, have you seen Ladybird?
No, I almost watched it the other day.
Well, there's a scene in Ladybird, it's in the trailer actually, when they're driving. I think she's off to uni and her mum is sort of yakking on, and she says, "Mum, stop." And she basically just opens the car door and rolls out. And I did feel a bit like doing that with my dad. Was he laughing about it? No, he was totally laughing. He was totally laughing. But it was a sort of, it was like the reverse of my dad wrote a porno. It was a very weird scenario having your dad read your sex lines back to you and sort of chuckle about them.
So have you had that a lot? Have you had a lot of people thinking that these are like first-hand experience? I mean, obviously it's going to be based off some kind of experience, but you had to be like, this isn't actually my autobiography.
Yeah, I have had to make that clear. Because obviously also, I should say, I worked at Tatler for 5 years. So obviously that's what Posh Magazine is based on.
Yeah.
And so yes, obviously it is a bit autobiographical. But I mean, I don't mind the fact that people might think the sex scenes are autobiographical, because I think we have all got better at talking about this kind of stuff, right? So whether it's poly or whether it's an experience that I've had, it's all up for discussion, right?
Yeah.
Everything's more out in the open. So I guess that's a good thing.
So I guess with the Posh and the Tatler parallels, was anyone affronted by any of that?
Yeah, I was quite worried. There was a moment when it was all announced. And I hadn't made a secret while I was working at Tatler that I was writing a book, or that it was a book. If anyone had asked, I would have said, yeah, it's sort of set in this Posh magazine. But then, yeah, very kindly, the Londoner's Diary on the Evening Standard did a sort of diary story when it was announced, saying, Sophia Money Coutts gives Tatler the Devil Wears Prada treatment.
Oh, no.
And I was obviously thrilled. I was like, yes, Devil Wears Prada's amazing, brilliant. And my editor, poor Kate, got a bit freaked out, I think, and had to sort of have words. And I just felt awful, and then wanted to really reassure her. So also gave her a copy, and it's fine.
Yeah, but it's funny, and it's fiction. And it's just a hyperbolic version of...
Yeah.
And we all know that those kind of stories and that kind of gentrified idea, it does exist. Just,
yeah.
It's there.
Anyway, and also it's affectionate. I never want to be sort of mean or bitchy about anything. I want to sort of be tongue-in-cheek, I suppose.
Yeah.
And have a laugh, but not at anyone's expense.
Yeah, it's just a bit of satire, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
But what else I think I wanted you to talk to you about was, as a woman, I mean, there's a lot of stress, obviously, in the novel and the concept about feeling that at a certain age you're supposed to have a boyfriend, or you're supposed to be...
I hate that.
Kind of like a man's going to fix your life or whatever. But what about in terms of career? Because, like you said, you and Polly both have fantastic careers, you're doing really well, and yet even as a woman in an amazing position, you feel like, oh God, I need a man to make my narrative better.
Yeah, I think that just has been always the narrative, hasn't it? And again, I think we're getting better at talking about it and realising that you can be absolutely perfectly fine and more than fine, very happy on your own, and God, you know, thank God for that. Because I can't bear that thing of, you know, I've been in that place. I think most of us have, where you think, oh, if only I met someone, then everything would be perfect, then everything would be sorted. And then you might meet someone and you might have a really wonderful, amazing relationship, but that's still not, everything's not sort of, as it were, sorted. I remember actually once a friend of mine who got married, and a single friend of hers said some remark along the lines of, well, it's all right for you because you're married, as if once you get married,
you just completed it.
Exactly, you completed life, and that's fine, and there's no, you don't have anything to deal with after that. But I mean, it's really not true. So yeah, it's that thing of, you have to sort of sort yourself out first before you go looking for someone else to fix you.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
It's really interesting, because I haven't reached that age. Obviously, I'm 24, but my sister's like in this bit where a lot of her friends are getting married, and my neighbour upstairs was saying she's at a point where she's the only one that's not married with babies, and she's like, I don't even want kids yet, but I can't be involved in the social fun anymore.
It's really hard
because the fun revolves around the babies and the husbands.
Yeah,
she's like about to get married, but I was like, God, that's so interesting, I'd never thought about it like that. She was like, I actually need to have a kid now to be like to hang out with my friends.
I know,
because then you forget that gets flipped.
Yeah, and then it's all about play dates and birthday parties and christenings and yeah, I mean, I am not married and I don't have children, but I do spend quite a lot of time with my mate's children, and it's so fun for a bit, and then you're a bit like, oh no,
I'm
that's
done
actually
now.
Enough, yeah,
so
enough like Peppa Pig.
Are most of your friends married now in your friendship group?
I would say, yeah, I reckon, so I'm 33, and I reckon the seesaw between the number of mates who are married versus not probably swung, say, like 2 years ago, and I felt like more people were married than weren't, and that, I was single at the time. I mean, I had a very dodgy sort of relationship in the past that made me feel really low for a long time, and I was in that place of, oh my God, what's wrong with me, I'm never going to meet anyone, and again, then I just focused. I mean, this book partly came out about that. I just sort of thought, right, I've got to focus on something else, and then I always, it's so annoying, that expression of, it happens when you least expect it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So annoying.
But I do think, what, can you talk a bit more about what happened in that relationship then, or what?
Yeah, it was just one of those relationships. I think I was always a sort of, I was a bit of a late starter, I guess, with boys. I was sort of at school, I was sort of tall and chubby and kind of, I was like the funny one, right? So I was the girl that boys would sort of, I joke with, but they never wanted to snog me. So at like parties or socials or whatever, other girls would be sort of snogging in the corner. And I'd be like, oh, here I am, sort of hovering, waiting awkwardly. And so I think what happened was when there was someone then did come along, and I'm talking now about sort of at university and then even after university in my 20s, someone would come along who was vaguely interested, and they might not have been the right person in many ways, but I was just like, yay, I've got a boyfriend, I'm like a normal person, I'm like everyone else around me, and I've got this boyfriend, so I'm really going to cling on, even though it could be a total disaster. And I'm not saying this is true with all my past relationships, but certainly, an ex-boyfriend of mine, it was really damaging, and he's quite a complicated character. Mm. I've written a story recently about it, and I was unquestionably head over heels in love, but it was completely the wrong sort of kind
like,
of love.
Like that passionate, toxic kind of love.
Really toxic. It was like we were addicted to one another, and it was so all-consuming, and he had a complicated scenario with an ex-girlfriend of his, and it was just, it really sort of screwed my head up for a while, and it was right at the stage when all my best girlfriends were getting married, so me breaking up with him at the same time as they were all going down the aisle really messed me up for a bit, I think, and I was totally in that place, like I said, of, oh my god, what's wrong with me, it's never gonna happen.
It's so weird, because that passionate, I've had that where you think that passionate love is like, this must be right, this is all the films,
this is what poets have talked about.
We make love, it's like amazing, and then you realize, like, I'm in a relationship now where it's just nice,
it's
just
lovely.
Calm, we don't argue,
not,
and I'm like, oh, this is it, but you can't,
no,
like, obviously that doesn't translate into a film or like,
no,
lots, there's no really ways to kind of to dramatize it, you actually disband the whole idea that I really thought for my whole youth that love was this like fire and passion, and that's what I would find. So I'd find someone that was completely antagonistic to everything I wanted to make that kind of
this is what we've been taught that we should have. Well, it's a bit like, so the intro of my book, right, have you seen Sense and Sensibility, the film? I saw that, I think I must have been maybe 12 or 13 when I saw that, right, and it's still like one of my favorite films ever, I am obsessed with it. But there is that scene when Kate Winslet, Marianne, goes off, she's heartbroken after Willoughby breaks her heart, and then she goes off walking when they get to that friend's house on the way back from London to look at his house distantly over the hill, and it's incredibly romantic, and she's sort of all sad and crying, and the storm sweeps in, and then she gets this fever and she nearly dies because she's so heartbroken. And I genuinely, having seen that at a very impressionable age, sort of thought that nearly dying for love was like the appropriate level of drama for a relationship.
But I think when you're younger as other, you do think you want it. Funnily enough, when I was at school, I actually used to date the boyfriend that I'm going out with now.
Oh, no way.
Not like officially or anything.
Sweet.
But when it ended, I remember lying in bed listening to Bon Iver and literally feeling like I was going to die.
Yeah.
I've had more serious breakups since then and not been as like deathly. Oh my God, I was like, like bawling. We'd been together for like a month or something. Like it wasn't even, we weren't even going out. But when you're little, things just, you feel things so deeply.
Much, which is kind of,
it's
wonderful,
harrowing.
In a way.
Yeah.
But it is wonderful, right? Like, it was Tracy Chapman for me. I used to wail to her.
Oh my God, And also Adele, someone like you, unfortunately came out then when I had like my big breakup. That was the worst.
Oh, Passenger. Passenger's big song. When I broke up with my ex, that
Let
was...
Her Go. Oh my God, I was on my gap. That was emotion. That's such a good song.
But it, literally now I almost can't listen to it because I'm like,
no,
oh,
I
God,
agree.
No, that puts me in a really bad place. I love Passenger, but just not that song.
Yeah, I know, I do actually have so many songs.
But I also, weirdly, I love Wallowing and stuff like that. Every now and then, a good wallow is amazing.
I love a good cry. Sorry, boyfriends. Yeah. Oh yeah, your friends being married.
Oh yeah, so that was a really bad moment for me. And then, so I sort of concentrated on work. I dated a few people between him and my current boyfriend, but it was sort of quite unsuccessful and I was in a sort of dodgy place. And so, I just sort of focused on work. And again, it's such an old cliche, but it is time, I think. When you've had a really dramatic heartbreak like that, you just need to sort of let it be and subside a bit and then get on with normal life.
Do you feel like when you're saying I was focusing on work, do you think in the back of your mind there was always that idea that you needed to meet someone but you just weren't pursuing that? Or do you think you genuinely were like, I'll just do work now, and then suddenly a time came when you wanted to date again?
I think there was always in the back of my mind, where is he? When am I going to meet him? And I think, I see it with girlfriends now. You go out for dinners or you go to weddings. I remember being single and going to weddings and being sort of a bit frantic about like, oh, who are the single guys
like
here?
You're going to like kind of looking around.
Who's the single guy here and who am I going to snog? And I don't think I've ever snogged anyone random at a wedding. I'm trying to think. Anyway, but you do go to also to a dinner party or something, you know, and you just think, right, who's the single person? Because yeah. And or you'd be sat next to someone who was married at a wedding. You'd think, well, that's a waste, isn't it? Because I'm not going to end up snogging you.
No one's going to speak to you.
And you get into that sort of frame of mind, which is really psychotic and so bad for you. But you can't help it.
I think you're like that when you're all single, though. Because I remember at uni, when it was really fun when we were all single, because we'd all go out like a pack of wolves.
Yeah.
And be scouting. It's not fun when only one of you single. Like, because now most of us are all in relationships. So when you go out, you just go out to dance with your girlfriends. But if one person's single, they yeah. want to like chase the night, and you're like, no, I'm going home at one.
I know.
And it's funny that dynamic that changes. But it is so bad because I don't know if guys do the same thing.
Well, if they do, it's sort of more, again, because they're men, it's sort of more accepted, isn't it? Yeah, men definitely go out and think, or
I'm going to pull
tonight. Whereas, yeah, I still think for girls, it's a bit sort of, it might be deemed a bit sort of unseemly in a way.
I don't know. I think that is a, because I do have girlfriends who are like, we're going to go out and pull tonight. Or even great. Get laid.
Like,
yeah.
Great. I mean, how good is that?
I've actually got a few friends who are all single. I know I'm in the happiest relationship ever, but the other day they were all like, we're all going to go out and get laid. And I was like, that's actually, I'm quite jealous. That sounds quite fun.
I'm going to stay in and watch
and they're all single. And I was like, oh, why have I missed this party? I feel like I was always in a relationship when everyone else was single.
That's difficult, the waves, isn't it? The waves yeah. of where you are versus where your friends
oh,
are.
Oh, there's definitely waves of breakups. And we just had a wave of breakups. And I was like, oh my God, is this me? No,
oh,
missed
shit,
it.
Am I the next? Yeah, okay, fine. So you wrote that one out.
I wrote that one out. But that definitely does happen.
Yeah, 100%.
But in terms of getting married now,
yes.
What's your view on that? Would you want to get married?
I'm quite weird about getting married. I never was one of those girls who dreamt about the wedding and the dress and the marquee or whatever. I just never, I don't know if it comes from being the child of divorced parents. My parents separated when I was 8.
Yeah.
My dad and mum actually both remarried within a couple of years, but then my mum divorced again when I was 18. So I sort of grew up with divorce, I think, very present. And I guess that maybe has informed me a bit. I don't know. I always have this debate. If you're the child of divorced parents, are you more likely to get divorced because you know that divorce isn't that big of a deal, you know, it yeah. happens and life goes on, or are you less likely because you're so determined to make it work
and believe in yeah
and really make a relationship last, unlike your parents? I don't know the answer to that. I just do know that I am very wary of marriage, and I am always thrilled pretty much when yet another friend, you know, sticks a picture up on Instagram of their hand and their engagement picture. And I love a wedding, but I do, it feels like such a rush. You know, it starts in the late 20s and then it carries on for years. Like, I go to weddings and I think, oh, are you doing this because everyone else is doing it?
I think or this like, is where my cynicism is as well, because I also think this also might just be me trying to be like, make everything into like, oh, it's because we do this. And I'm like, why do you need to get married? It's such an old-fashioned thing. I'm not remotely religious.
Yeah.
If I got married, I certainly wouldn't do it in a church
saying vows, like,
and then if I got to, yeah, I'd have to write something else. And yeah. then at the end of the day, I'm like, fair enough, you can buy me a massive rock, I will wear a ring, but like, do we need to get married? I don't know. But then I don't know if that's just me being annoying and nitty-gritty about, like, because my boyfriend would just be like, it's just a nice thing to just do it for your family, just do it, you know.
Well, yeah, no, my boyfriend feels very strongly about it, and because, you know, he wants to, and we actually, it's great, we have really open conversations about it, and I have from the very beginning, in fact, I've just written a piece in which I mentioned this. I think boys do this quite often at the start of a relationship. On late, like maybe date 5 or 6, Lloyd said to me, oh, I'm never getting married, by the way. And I think they do it as a sort of test. It's like,
oh, really?
Are you a psycho? Are you Glenn Close? Or how, like, where do you fall on that scale? So I instantly shot back. Oh, actually, yeah, no, me neither. And he then looked a bit surprised. I was like, oh, what?
Oh, that's
and
so
I was like,
funny.
Yeah, well, my family divorced, so I just have never really pictured it. I'm a bit weird about marriage. And he was like, oh. And then it came up again quite early, quite a few times. He was like, well, if you don't want to get married, like, why are we doing this?
Oh,
and in my
so
head,
strange.
You totally don't have to be in a relationship. The end goal of a relationship isn't marriage.
No.
I don't have an issue with being with someone and having children with them and hopefully having
married.
A very happy life with them and not getting married.
I think the really weird thing about relationships in general is that you project so much of the future that, like, people are constantly thinking about what's going to happen in the future that you don't enjoy the now.
Yeah.
And that's why I think breakups are so hard. You could have been going out with someone for 2 years, but technically you've gone out with them for 40 because you've planned, like,
yeah.
your wedding, your kids. So when you break up, you're breaking up, like, a whole
life. Yeah, yeah.
And I think people would enjoy... I think I've spoken about this before, but this... The idea of monogamy being so absolute every single time you get into a relationship makes the idea in of itself slightly redundant, because every single time I've gone out with someone, obviously you think they're the one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So by proxy, clearly that doesn't. So I don't know. I just feel this idea of like condemning a relationship to have to fit into marriage.
Yeah. Well, also just the pressure of it. I mean, my brother, I love him. He's quite hippie. He once said to me, "Soft life is about a series of beautiful relationships. It's not necessarily just about one."
Yeah.
And I kind of agree. I would love to be. I mean, I hope I am with my boyfriend forever and ever. But you don't know, do you? And I think, why can't you take each month, each year as
exactly.
it comes, and not put the pressure of standing in a church, as you said, when very few people now believe in those religious sentiments anyway, promising to be together forever, when, you know, we live until we're sort of
exactly.
900 these days. It's a really long time.
That's the thing they were saying, like, if we lived until we're like 200, imagine you're having children would be such a small portion of your life.
Yeah, yeah.
You would actually, you might even get to the point where you wouldn't even really know your children, or you yeah. certainly wouldn't know that all of their children's children.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just find it very interesting. I completely agree with the idea that also, divorce, it's really funny because divorce is so common and people get with each other so frequently. But the idea of being like, I'm going to go into a relationship to enjoy it for however long it lasts, whether that brings me children as well.
Yeah.
And that's really, people are like, you can't say that.
I know,
you
exactly.
You have to believe, and you yeah. do believe it's rather, otherwise you probably wouldn't engage in
otherwise,
it.
Otherwise, why would you bother at all?
But I just think it's a very strange idea that when we realise that actually divorce is quite common and that things aren't necessarily forever, and also just the trajectory of lives, especially probably with women being more mobilised in society and
yeah.
doing more things, the trajectory we're working off is based off of such old ideas.
Yeah,
it doesn't really translate into life now.
No, the one sort of immovable thing is the our women's biological clocks, right? So
yes.
I went to see my gynecologist the other day.
Did you?
Very personal detail, and he was like. And I was just talking about children and in general, very much in general. And I was saying, because, you know, in an ideal world, I wouldn't for 5-6 years.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't, because I feel like I'm having such a lovely time now. I've gone freelance and I've got this book coming out and then I'm going to write another one and I'm doing so much cool stuff and I'm so happy with Lloyd and we have a lovely time. And I see friends with babies who are shattered and exhausted and
yeah.
the women, obviously, because it just naturally still does fall to them, have to put their lives and their jobs more on hold. It's really tough. And my gynecologist looked at me and sort of, you know, grimaced a bit. And he went, if I can give you one bit of advice, and I'm not really meant to, but if I can, I would say in the next 2 years. And you're suddenly like, because that changes so much. And if you, and yeah, so he's basically saying, get on with it. And
this
he's like,
is exactly
but no, I'm not
what
old enough.
I had
I'm
this conversation with my boyfriend because he said, I remember enough, he denies this, but it wasn't even a date. We're just on a walk somewhere because we're friends. I'll do something.
Mm.
And he was like, I want to have kids before I'm 30. And I remember being like, what the heck? Because that's in like
yeah.
a few years. But also, if I could choose to, and I knew I could, I would wait until I was 40. That's
yeah.
when I'll probably be ready, realistically.
Yeah.
With my career,
yeah, exactly.
with where I want to be, I'll be financially stable years old,
mm.
which probably won't happen for a while, especially with houses at the minute.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that, I just think that's too soon. I'm just not
yeah.
ready to have a kid.
Yeah.
And it kills me. And also, I can't afford to freeze my eggs. And like, it's so stressful. I just don't think guys ever really realise that feeling of like...
Well, just how much we still will be sacrificing compared to them, which
yeah.
is, I know some people will probably say is unfair, but it's true. If I look at my girlfriends who've all had babies, they have put their lives on hold a hell of a lot more
yeah.
than the guys.
And when I did an episode with the gynecologist and she was saying realistically, she was like, all these people say you should get tested and see about your fertility. And she was like, I would advise any woman personally, she's like, if you haven't had a baby yet and you haven't had the right man, just and maybe try and find a way to do it later on in life, but don't force it. She was like, because I think what you'll find is, she was like, I do have lots of women who will just, or they'll do a test to find out they're fertile, find out that maybe it's running out of time and go and literally find a man,
yeah.
have a baby with him, and then actually your life in a funny way is almost worse off than if you just seen what
yeah.
happened and maybe
you
adopted
never
or
yeah.
never knew and just didn't
in
try to
time someone came along.
Because the other narrative is that you have to have a baby as a woman, you should
yeah.
want to have a
well,
kid
exactly.
So even if you didn't want one and you didn't think you wanted one, if you suddenly get told it's running out of time, people must just
yeah.
go stir crazy and
exactly.
think, shit, I've got to.
So in my head, I've slightly got a 2-year timer now, and that just does put a lot more pressure on a relationship, I think. And yeah, as you said, I don't even know when I go to my friends', you know, children's birthday parties or go around for dinner, I do sometimes look at it and think, but do I really? I mean, I'm not actually very broody. I don't have that thing in me yet. Maybe it suddenly
yeah.
kicks in one morning when you wake up. So I definitely am not there yet. So yeah, I don't even know if I want that to happen.
That's
at all. But
yeah.
here's your doctor saying, do it, think about it. It's just terrifying.
Is it bad that I'm annoyed that he's a man saying that as well?
He's actually the loveliest man in the whole world.
Is
so
he?
I didn't feel too cross at him. I know he's only wanting to sort of...
give you the option,
do
yeah.
what, say what's best, but it does put a whole load of pressure. I mean, in my head, I'm always still amazed, frankly, that I can drive and I pass my driving test. You know what I mean? I feel like I'm sort of 17. Well, I don't feel like I should be weighing up whether to have a child or not.
This is what I think. I just feel so much younger than... I don't know. I just can't believe that the people doing fully fledged jobs.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just feel like it's... And it's funny because when you're like 16, I remember thinking someone's 23 or 25.
So old.
So old. So mature.
I know.
I'm really glad that they've now said that you're not officially an adult until you're like 25. Because it used to be it was 18. But I think psychologically now they've said it's 25.
Can we just push it back? Push it back later and later.
Yeah, I know. It's madness.
Yeah.
But yeah, so moving on, talking about that actually, and careers-wise and things, how did you, because I think what a lot of people, and I myself get this as well, we were talking about imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
And classic. In your work and now, did you know what you wanted to do when you were younger? How did you get into this path?
Yeah, I was quite lucky, I think, in that I did know that I wanted to write and be a journalist. A lot of my mum's side of the family are journalists. So I sort of grew up hearing about it, and I mean, maybe it was quite naive in a way, just assumed in an arrogant way. Oh, that's what I'm going to do.
Who did your mum write for?
She wrote for a lot of sort of country magazines. Her father was a journalist and writer and editor of the Telegraph for many years. And his son, my uncle, went to work for Telegraph for many years. His son, my cousin, now works for the Mail. Another one used to work there. And so there's just various sort of journalists peppered around, basically. So a bit like, well, like any careers that run in the family, you sort of assume, well, that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
And then I realised I went to LSE for uni, London School of Economics, where everyone is going off to be an incredibly high-powered lawyer or banker or consultant. And I was like the class clown because I was going to go off and be a journalist.
What made you choose LSE then?
Because I didn't get into Oxford twice.
Okay.
and actually, I'm not sure I would go to London again now. I think if I could go back, I would...
Get the uni experience.
I'd get the uni experience. Yeah. I totally didn't have that.
Yeah. Both my sisters went to London unis, and they're like, there's no point. You just hemorrhage money and you don't...
You hemorrhage money and you... Really... I mean, I went out with my tutor for 2.5 years. So
amazing.
Actually,
so much fun.
So I never want to take it back because we're still really good friends and he's wonderful. So
this
I never
is,
wanna...
Wait, this is the best story. Why have you written a book about that?
So, yeah, well, he was in my first year. I took a political philosophy course, and he taught political philosophy.
Oh my god, I can already tell.
So
amazing.
Exactly, like American, talking about Rousseau and things.
Oh,
and yeah, I always sort of had a bit of a crush. And then towards the end of the year, we were having mock exams, and I emailed him saying I couldn't make one of the mock exams. I'd messed up my dates. And actually, at the time, I was blonde. I'm brunette, but I was blonde back then. And I said, I'm really sorry I've been so blonde, but I just messed up the date, so can I do another mock date? And he came back. I mean, you'd probably get in trouble for saying this now. And said, absolutely fine, don't worry about the dates. P.S. I've always wondered, do blondes have more fun? I mean, so cringe, actually, now,
oh
when you think
god,
about
no,
it.
Oh my god, no, but that's so much
me,
fun. How old are you, 18?
I was, no, 19.
That is the most fun thing that could ever happen
so you're
in your
just
life.
Like, oh my god, well, that was
that's
it. So
like
I
a movie.
Then sent, I mean, like the world's most cringe email back saying...
Was
well,
this on your uni email?
Have a drink
on
and
his,
find
like,
out.
Emails.
Yeah, I think it was both on my... So bad.
So good.
Anyway, so, yeah, we should...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Have a drink and find out. And actually, our first date was in Brixton. So, because he lived in Peckham and I was living in Brixton at the time.
How old was he?
So, he was, I mean, he's not like, when I said tutor, he's not like 900 years old. He
no,
was
yeah.
34. So
we had a really young, sexy Scottish teacher that we all tried to flirt with and he just shut it down. We all were like, hi, Martin. He like, all right, girls, and just walk off and we're like, bye. Oh. And I think he actually hated it because in this day and age as well, you just
you
can't,
get in so much trouble because
like,
so one thing.
Just had to like, be yeah, like, go yeah. away.
Anyway, yeah, so we went on the first date in Bristol. He was 15 years older than me, which, yeah, isn't, I mean, so he was 34 at the time, which, and that's basically my age now, but at the time it seems sort of very much older. Anyway, and we did go out for 2.5 years, and it was sort of sexy for the first bit because
yeah.
we had to keep it secret at uni.
Such fun.
But then I was sort of, it was wonderful, but it was one of those things. I was really young. I wanted to sort of go off and have adventure and live abroad, so we broke up. And it was, yeah, that was my first sort of real major
Looking
breakup.
Looking back now, because I think of my 19-year-old self, and she was an absolute dickhead and also like an actual child. Do you think, look back and like feel like you were old? Because I felt, and now I look back and I'm not even that much older than that. I'm only 5 years older, but my god, I think I've changed
sometimes,
so
although
much.
Sometimes, do you ever look back and think, I think I was maybe more wise then?
No, oh my God, no, I can't
even. Wisdom, I was... and I make sort of weirder decisions now.
Oh no, I was actually awful.
The one thing I really remember actually with the relationship with him was an absolute lack of jealousy about anything, which is, like, I suppose because at 19 you're a sort of blank slate, you haven't got much emotional baggage, yeah. hopefully. And I remember once, I was never, like, he'd broken up fairly recently with his ex, and he was going to stay with her family in France for a weekend, and I was just like, yeah, cool, fine, like, don't worry about it.
Did you think he worshipped the ground you walked on? Did you feel very much like, because you were this young student?
Well, but I think it went both ways. Like, I, you know, loved him and he yeah. loved me, and it was a sort of quite a grown-up relationship despite the age gap. But God, if now Laurie said to me, yeah, I'm just going to go and stay with Mike's girlfriend and her family for the weekend, I'd be like, are you kidding me? I'd lose my shit. And so maybe it's because you're young and you just haven't developed
That's
sort of
really
all those, like...
I guess if no one's ever broken your trust,
yeah.
then you wouldn't have a reason to.
Yeah.
I've had to go the opposite. So I was fine. Then I got jealous because someone broke my trust, and I've had to train myself not to be jealous.
Oh,
because
it's the worst emotion.
Otherwise, you can carry jealousy with you into situations that don't warrant any jealousy
yeah, it's
for
so
no
pointless.
Reason.
I'm so destructive. I hate it.
It is.
It's a really hideous, horrid sort of gremlin that sits
yeah.
in your head and can just pop up and say and just needle you with little things.
I remember I had a manager at Bergman Lobster when I used to work there as a student, and I remember her just saying something to me like, jealousy only affects you, it
yeah.
doesn't fix anything. And I remember something just yeah. switched in my head, and then if I ever got jealous, and she was, oh, this was it, she was like, once my boyfriend cheated on me and everyone was like, you should have got jealous, that like, you could have seen it coming, but she was like, but I would have just gone through it twice.
Yeah,
she was like, if they're gonna do something, they're gonna do it whether or not you're snooping through their phone,
yeah,
or whether or not you try to catch them out. So she's
yeah.
like, you just have to implicitly trust someone until they prove you wrong.
Well, also, you can, when you see it in other, if I see it in Friends, say jealousy, or say on like Love Island, if you could see some of the women being jealous,
yeah.
it's a really unattractive
yeah.
thing. But when you're in the grip of it, it feels
it's
like
horrible.
You can't help yourself, and trying to turn off that bit of your brain and reassure yourself is really hard.
I think I very rarely feel anxious, and one of the only times I feel anxious is when I feel fear of like jealousy,
yeah,
or one of those emotions. Horrid. It really like stops me in my tracks.
Well, it's also all consuming, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you can go down some sort of Instagram phone hole and
oh,
be like, what am I doing? How have I found myself
I
here?
It's so bad. But the worst thing is with girls as well, we'd put it like in a group chat and you'd all just come up with this whole scenario from like
yeah.
one thing.
Yeah.
And then they'd be like, he didn't text me back, and we'd be like, oh my God, it's this, and you just find out that like his phone had died.
I've got to say, in fact, actually, I did this on the weekend. Lloyd and I went out for lunch, and I left my phone at home. I just forgot it, and we were having lunch with some of my friends, and so he didn't have their number. So I was like, oh, come on, I just sign into Instagram on your phone.
Yeah.
And send them a message. So he signed in, and he tapped. I was like, oh, he's called Tom, and his girlfriend. And he was typing in his girlfriend's name, and an ex-girlfriend of Lloyd's came up, and I was like, oh, and he was like, why were you looking up? And I was like, oh my god.
No, don't.
Because
he
literally mentioned her in brief the other day, seeing her at something, he's been away, and I'd then been that psycho, then
the
gone
people
in
the ice talk, you don't, my mum loves it.
I mean, we can all be completely rational women on the face of it, can't we? But underneath, I do think, I mean, I could write a book about Instagram.
I stalk people that my friends don't like. It's quite nice to stalk someone that you don't like.
Yeah.
I don't really have anyone that I don't like anymore, so I have to stalk.
Well, that's healthy.
Yeah, well, I think that's
but quite... who are you going to stalk then?
Exactly. So I start to stalk people that my girlfriends don't like, and I'm like, you're annoying. And it's really bad. And then they're like, oh, that's who I stalk. It's really, there is like a real pleasure. It's a very weird thing. Like, hate stalking is a thing.
Yeah, I mean, I just, yeah. It's terrible. It's really
it's
bad.
Really
you find
bad.
Yourself going down this hole and you just can't stop it.
I know. It is. Social media is really awful for that. And I do have that absolute fear. I'm like, one day I am going to get caught and I am just going to like this girl's picture. And
yeah,
I'm like,
exactly.
And I know. I feel the fear in me.
Yeah.
I know it's going to happen one day.
You almost know you don't want it to happen. I was thinking like, do you almost want it to happen a bit? But no, you really don't.
No.
Like, oh.
This happened with...
Isn't that the 5-second rule though, supposedly? Someone's told me before on Instagram. If you accidentally like a picture and then unlike it
in 5 seconds.
If their phone's
unlocked, it's fine as long as they're not on it. But if they're lock screen, it doesn't matter what you do, it'll stay there. But yeah, that is awful. I actually think it's so bad talking about stalking like stuff like that, because you say it out loud and you just think,
I know, but if we at least if we say it out loud, then it's
you're
missing, because everyone
flaws.
Does it, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's just one of those bad things.
But what other things?
Career. No, we got
yeah,
hang on, we got completely diverted from
yeah,
the
sorry
thing. so anyway LSE was it was more about my mad sort of yeah not mad, lovely relationship with my tutor. Anyway, and then, yeah, so I knew I wanted to be a journalist. I was at LSE, but everyone was getting, like, very lucrative trainee schemes for, like, Goldman Sachs, and they were all going off to banks, and I was like, oh my God, how do you... There aren't really lucrative trainee schemes for newspapers or magazines. So I went to work for a sort of... it's called contract publishing, which is if a business like Sainsbury's or British Airways wants a magazine, then they approach a publishing house and pay them to produce a magazine. So British Airways does have one, Sainsbury's does have one. I went to work for one, a magazine that did, sort of ludicrously posh, they did the magazine for Annabelle's, the club, Aspinall's, the casino and stuff, because just someone had said, oh, they're looking for like a features assistant, basically. So I did that in my uni summer holidays, and then from there got an interview for the Evening Standard for a job on the features desk there, basically, and had a terrible interview because I was so nervous and sweat. I couldn't stop sweating. But I think because I was, I mean, I did work for three, I think, for 3 months. The then editor, Veronica Wadley, took me on. And that was kind of it. I think once you've got your, in industries like journalism, once you've got your foot in the door, it's just sort of up to you to really cling on like a limpet and do whatever you can do to, you know, put yourself out or go and get your, I remember buying my boss's tights and getting coffees and just doing all that crap. Because you've just got
to
hang
on. Well, I think in any like content creating industry, you just have to push out as much stuff, like to the point where you're just constantly doing it all the time.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one, I think, because I saw this with people who came into work experience at Tatler, of trying to be sort of helpful and nice and not annoying, but also you want to be like, I've written this thing, or I've done this thing, or can you take a look at this? And I get it.
How do you platform yourself in like a situation where, I think I've got a bit better now, but for instance, like that, when you really know that you're the underdog, but you really feel like a piece of work has credence.
Yeah.
How do you be like, actually, please, I think this deserves your point of view. Like, what would you suggest?
I think it's about, if you can email someone and really take time with an email, it's not sort of dear so-and-so, that it's not clearly a generic thing that you've sent out to loads of people. It would be, you know, dear, in my case, sort of dear Sophia, hi, mentioning, I've had this before where people will mention, oh, I love that piece that you wrote this, or I love that. That like just shows that you've taken a bit of time. Yeah. And also, because I was an editor at the Mail and then at Tatler. And so if you're an editor and you're getting loads of pitches a day from people, if someone's taken the time to personalize something, then it's very hard to, it sort of lodges in your brain a bit more. It's really hard to just delete that email on site. You can't, because that's incredibly rude, and someone's obviously taken the time to get in touch with you. So even if an editor doesn't immediately go, great, we'd love to run it, we'll print it tomorrow, at least you've made a sort of human connection, as opposed to just sending out something which is clearly has gone to 20 different people.
What about, really interesting, I want to ask you about working at the Daily Mail as a woman.
People always say it in a sort feel a bit sort of, I mean, you know, because everyone hates the Daily Mail, and I always sort of say it quite quietly.
No, but everyone hates the Daily Mail, but everyone also fervently reads the TV and show.
The thing is, as a journalist, whatever your politics, and I was there with Helen Lewis, who's now the deputy editor of New Statesman. I was on the same desk as her, and she's amazing. Obviously, she's gone off in a completely different direction, and is so super successful and so intelligent.
I don't think it's any reflection on you. I was more interested in like if it was as not even misogynistic, but just as like as a woman working there.
There's always sort of, the thing that I know is true is that certain pages in the female section, women aren't supposed to be photographed in trousers or jeans. If you look at the pages of Female, which comes out on a Thursday in the paper, all the women will be in dresses or skirts. That's still, I mean, the editor, Paul Dacre, is stepping down though this year. So I'm really interested. And Geordie Gregg, who's the editor of the Mail on Sunday, ex-editor of Tatler, is moving to be editor of the Mail. So it's really interesting to see if that will change. I mean, yes, it was a very sort of macho, testosterone-y environment, but then most newsrooms are, to be fair.
I mean, I guess most industries in general are.
Yeah, exactly. And newsrooms are just very, very shouty and can be very aggressive and stressful. And so, yes, they're not very inviting workplaces, or haven't traditionally been for women. But working at the Mail for 2 years was the most amazing training, I always say. It's sort of, you get thrown in and it's sink or swim, basically. And a load of people go through it. A lot of journalists go through it. And many journalists who are, you know, left wing would have to admit the Mail is, you know, very professionally run, incredibly successful paper, whatever you think.
It's a very good
politics.
Business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a very difficult industry, it's still, you know, making money. So
did you feel like so now that you've finally gone freelance, do you feel like you've finally worked up to the point where you can actually say and do and be who you want to be?
Yeah, I wanted to leave. So I went from the Mail to Tatler for I was at Tatler for 5 years, and I wanted to go freelance for a while. But I was just like, shit, how do I make that happen? Yeah. Because, oh my God, if I don't have a salary, and how am I going to support myself? And it basically took getting the book deal for me to think, okay, that's all right, I can leave. And even if I only get commissioned one piece a month, I can just about manage. And then you, and then you leave. And actually, it's, I mean, I really love Tatler, and I love the sort of madness of writing about Dukes and Labradors and all of that, and going around leaky castles and, you know, the mad, wonderful things that I got to do for 5 years at Tatler were kind of extraordinary and obviously have sort of informed the book. But I did want to get away a little bit from endless Labrador jokes. And, you know, that I think... Yeah, I still love writing about posh people, and I'm fascinated, and I think this country remains not quite fascinated with sort of class. Yeah. But I'd like to do some other stuff as well.
Yeah. So. Do you feel like a little bit of that was like almost underwriting the whole thing was just a self-belief that actually you could just go and do it on your own?
Yes. I mean, I needed the sort of the book deal, I think, to give me that confidence.
Yeah.
I needed something, a sort of push. And a little bit, I mean, I got a column in Sunday Telegraph just before I got the book deal. So that was another thing which meant
amazing.
I could jump and go. Yeah. And then you, so it's just little, it bit by bit. But I mean, God, jumping from a job with a salary to in London to no salary, you know, you'd have to be pretty mad.
Was there always a novel at the end of your story? Not at the end, in the middle of your story.
Was I always going to write one?
Well, yeah, did you, was it journalism? And then would you thought like at some point I want to be an author, or was it that just happened?
Yeah, I did always want to do a book. And actually I lived in Abu Dhabi for 2 years after the Evening Standard, because I've been in London for ages. I went away and lived out there. Have you been out to Dubai or Abu Dhabi?
I've been to Dubai, yeah.
So quite a weird part of the world to live in for two years. And people are really, I get quite defensive sometimes about the Gulf because people can be really snotty about it, about Dubai and this sort of silliness. But it just doesn't pretend to be anything else, right? It sort of just pretends to be mad hotels and water parks and all of that. So I had sort of 2 years out there working for a newspaper, which was an amazing adventure. And I did actually start a book and nearly get a deal when I was out there, which was a sort of single life in the desert, single girl's life in the desert kind of thing. Because, oh my God, expat society, I'm weirdly fascinated by. I don't know if you've read White Mischief.
No.
I don't know if any listeners have read White Mischief. It's this amazing book about Kenya and the sort of expat society in the sort of 20s, 30s, into the
40s. I can imagine that's amazing.
And they were all sort of drinking champagne, taking morphine and just misbehaving and affairs and shagging all the time.
Even my parents, when they lived in Saudi, mum was like, they lived in a complex.
Oh, well, yeah, if they lived out there,
and she was like,
thing.
The women would come over and they were buyers and they'd take it off and underneath they'd all have like the most expensive Chanel, Gucci, like amazing perfume. And she would be gobsmacked because they'd all come over. But because my parents were in a British, because my dad was a doctor, so he'd be in like the British complex bit.
Yeah.
So they could take their, because they weren't technically, I don't really know how it worked, but she was like, oh my God, we go to bed early, they'd be drinking moonshine.
Yeah, it's sort of extraordinary. But I do think there's something that happens with expat, whether it is Hong Kong or Singapore or Dubai. I think it's, people go out there to work for a bit. It's not really real life, right? You think, well, real life is when I come home.
I think you get sucked in as well.
Totally,
you can't escape
in.
It.
It's all, everyone sort of spends the weekend. It's like being on holiday, basically, the whole time. Everyone's on boats and on the beach on the weekends. Probably everyone's earning a bit more money as well.
Yeah, a lot of tax.
So it creates a sort of mad crucible. And I did start writing a book about being a sort of single girl and the affairs and the drinking and the, everything that went on around me, and was really gutted when that deal fell through. But I'm actually quite glad now.
So what would that? What happened to that story then?
Well, it was non-fiction, so I didn't write the whole thing. I wrote sort of the first chapter and the middle chapter and a synopsis, and did get quite close to something, and then just fell through. And so I just sort of gave up. It really gutted me for a while, actually. And I thought, well, that's it. That's
could you not revisit
failure.
That, though, and then
well,
fictionise it later on?
Well, I think with writing, nothing is ever wasted. Yeah. So, like Nora Ephron said, everything's copyright. So I think, you know, I can use bits of that in other stuff. But I'm quite glad now, I think, that didn't ever see the light of day. Because I think I would have just been writing stuff to get a book deal, right?
Yeah.
And no matter what it said about me, I would have just been chucking it out and be like, yeah, I've got a book, even though it reveals lots of like innermost stuff, which I might not have been that comfortable with.
At a later date, yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds, you sound like you've had the most incredible career, that you've done so many things.
I feel very, like, very lucky. And I feel like it was quite an odd decision in a way to go out to the Gulf when I was like 23, but I'm so glad I did. And I always actually say to people, I think living abroad is an amazing thing to do.
Yeah, I really want
to. If you can go and live somewhere else for a bit, you know, we've got our whole lives to be home, wherever home is. Or London or wherever, but I think going and working abroad is amazing. And I always think that my mates who are expats, I think you can quite often tell if someone's lived abroad. There's just a more open mentality that you can sit down next to someone who's been abroad and instantly be like, hey, like, what's your story? Who are you? And chat. Whereas I think if you stay in the same place and you stay in the same friendship groups your whole life, you sort of can become quite close-minded.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's just really important to displace yourself. I think you can get so kind of, it's funny because actually I think you're right, it gets accelerated. I know friends who move out to Dubai and it's like you get used to the money and the culture and you get sucked in, and it's like quite hedonistic and exaggerated. Totally. But that still happens on a diluted level in London.
Yeah,
it's just like you just get so used to this London way, you know. And I bet if you go home to the country for a weekend, you don't feel like you've been there for 3 weeks.
Yeah,
and then you come back to London.
I regress when I go home to the country and I open my mum's fridge and I'm like, I'm gonna eat 10 pieces of toast like I'm a teenager,
and all the cheese acceptable. I don't even eat cheese and I'm like, this is great. Yeah.
But with me, I just feel very lucky. Like, I just, it's been sort of a decisions that I've made at the time that have taken me on a certain path. It wasn't like, yes, I did want to write a book at some point, but it wasn't, nothing was very premeditated, right? So it wasn't like back when I was at the Evening Standard, I was plotting my moves like on a chessboard, like, oh, right, yeah, after this, I'm going to go abroad for a bit and then I'm going to come back and then I'm going to work for Tatler. In fact, I really didn't want to work for Tatler.
But you know,
I tried really hard not to work for Tatler. I got offered a job twice before, and because I've got like the world's silliest, poshest, maddest name, I didn't want to be Sophia Money Coutts who went to work for Tatler.
Right.
Like, that's the world's most embarrassing cliche. And then I sort of went and had a lovely time and realised how great it was.
But do you think as well, because if you weren't, I'm assuming that when you went away, you weren't in a relationship?
I was just coming out of the relationship with a tutor. So that was part of it.
So do you think that had you been in a very stable relationship, say from the age of 23 or 24, do you think you would have had all the experiences that you had?
No, probably not. I probably would have been less, because I'm also deeply, a bit like Marianne in Sense Sensibility, super romantic. So I think I might have thought, for them, I'm going to stay. But I don't, you're too young, I think. I'm so glad at age 23 I went away. I mean, I don't want to sound patronising and say anyone's too young for a certain thing, because it totally depends on you, obviously.
Well. And I'm also this romantic, and this stresses me out because I really hope that I won't do this. But I know that, say, if I wanted to go somewhere and my boyfriend was like, I want to stay.
Yeah.
I literally tell myself, I'm like, if you want to do it, you have to do it. You have to do it.
Yeah.
Do you think that you now would take an opportunity? Well, you could never
say. It's difficult. Again, I think that might be something that changes in your 30s. Yeah. I would now, say something came up and I was going to go away again. I don't know if I would.
But then you've done it as well.
And I have done it. Although, I mean, I really, really, really love travelling. I'm obsessed with travelling. And part of the reason for going freelance was that I wanted to do more travelling. So I do want to do much more of that. And, you know, I'm going, I'm really excited. Telegraph is sending me to Japan next month.
Whereabouts are you going?
Tokyo and Kyoto and Osaka. Because I write this column for the Telegraph about, it's called Modern Manners. So it's sort of about etiquette in a sort of like modern way, right? Like, don't use your phone on the loo. Do this, then
on
do
the
that.
Loo.
Yeah, I wrote a column once about how we should really like not feel so bad about using.
I know,
we all do it.
Phone.
Obviously, we all do it.
I have a
break,
even when no one's here. You know, when you're doing work and you know you're not meant to go on a phone, I do it to like hide from myself that I've gone on my phone. So I'll be doing work, but I work from home. There's no one to tell me if I go on my phone.
So you just take your phone to the loo.
So when I go for a wee, I go on my phone then, because I'm like, well, it's not technically.
Well,
in the office.
No, you totally all do it. But I sort
that's
of.
That's really interesting. What? Because you need to be conscious about your.
Well, it's just like sort of hygiene in a way.
Oh, that's so true.
Yeah, it's a little bit like, a little bit like that. And also, are you like, my brother's one of those people who has a little plaster over his camera on his laptop. Are you one of those people?
No, I'm not. And I always have FaceTime over it. Mine's always green. They're probably watching me the whole time.
I sometimes think if I've got my phone on the loo, I'm like, oh my god, is someone watching?
See, I'm really lackadaisical about that kind of stuff, because mine will always have the green. I've had friends say that to me before, because I'm one of these annoying people that doesn't close tabs and shit's open.
Yeah.
My friends are like, they're literally watching me. I'm like, bloody hope exactly. I'm sat in my room. I'd be acting out scenes and stuff. They'll be like, oh god, yeah, that would be horrendous.
So I write this column about etiquette and modern manners, and so the Telegraph said, could I go to Japan and go somewhere where they also they have quite serious rules about etiquette and manners.
Yeah.
And I said, yes, please, I've always wanted to go, but everyone's always said it's incredibly expensive. It's like a once in a lifetime kind of holiday in Japan. So point being, I really want to do more travel, but it's difficult when you're in a sort of serious long-term relationship going away, and my boyfriend travels quite a lot as well, so you do slightly have to think about it and coordinate a bit more, as opposed to being like, oh, sod it, I'm just going to go here and then go there. And I definitely think about it a bit more consciously now, but I think that's more because I'm in my 30s, so that's just the stage
that I've got to
basically. And maybe it is because I feel like I've been lucky and I have travelled quite a lot before.
Interesting. Amazing. Yeah. So going forwards, more books?
Yes. My deadline for book two is really soon. It's the end of November. This is part of the problem actually with the Japan trip. I booked a cottage in Yorkshire for 7 weeks.
I love that.
I know, to go in October and for most of November to basically remove myself from London, Go somewhere where there's incredibly dodgy Wi-Fi.
I'm imagining, I know it's in the Cotswolds, but you know, the holiday. In the holiday, yeah. I'm imagining that cottage.
Yeah, so am I a bit in my head. I've only seen a picture on like Google Maps, so I have no idea what it's like. Oh, really? I just put a thing on Facebook and I've sort of, you know, you've got your friends and people on Facebook that you haven't spoken to for 100 years.
Or ever spoken to.
Yeah, but this guy just popped up and he said, me and my brother have this place in Yorkshire, so it'd be nice to have someone in it. So it's incredibly cheap rent, which was really nice of him. So I'm slightly imagining it like the holiday as well, but it might not be.
So do you think once you've done it, because I guess the first thing about like, I'm going to write a book, you've written a book, that's amazing. Does that not feel amazing?
Well, again, a bit like imposter syndrome. It's sort of like, yeah, I guess I have. And even when I hold it,
it's like an actual novel.
Yeah, no, it's a really wonderful feeling. And I sort of still can't believe it. I basically, the way I wrote this book, because I did it while I was still at Tatler, I used to go to Pret on Hanover Square and sit every morning and do an hour sort of before work writing, you know, sex scenes in Pret while everyone got their coffees around me. And then if I was feeling energetic, I'd go and do an hour over lunch as well. But there were great like stretches of months when I couldn't be bothered and I was really idle. And then my poor, very long-suffering agent would send me an email going, hello, any further? So that was how I did that one. And then it just suddenly was book-shaped and it was long enough for a book and I sent it off. But it does feel... again, mentioning imposter syndrome, like a sort of happy accident in a way. Like I'm just very bad at sort of owning it.
Yeah, it's funny as well because you said about four times that you're so lucky, but you've literally also just told me all the different types of jobs you did and the months that you spent not being paid and like how you applied.
Does it sound like false modesty as well?
Sound false at all. No, it didn't. It literally like, I'm so lucky to have gone and got a degree and worked alongside my degree and done internships and just happened to get this job. It's so weird that they could take me. And I was listening to it and I was thinking, not annoying. It's not luck, but I think it's a massive thing to learn when you grow up is that we were talking about it just before that you can just realise that you've worked hard for something. I don't know why we're just taught that you have to be, it's just so fortunate this has happened. Checking your privilege is one thing, that's great.
Yeah.
But when you've literally written a whole book.
Yeah.
It didn't just fall out of the sky.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just appear on my laptop. Yeah. There are loads of egg and tomato baguettes from Pret that made that happen.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever get over it. I mean, I hope we will. It's just the great thing about it, and I'm happy this is happening more, especially with female authors, is the rawness and the realness and the real, funnily enough, unapologeticness about it, which is funny in regards to what we've been speaking about being very kind of nervous to be self-accepting.
Oh, that bit, I know I mentioned this before, that bit, the loo bit. When Polly wakes up.
I haven't got to the loo bit.
Okay, well, this is just something that a girlfriend of mine said to me last week. She's like, oh my God, that bit is my favourite bit. Which is when, so Polly wakes up. I don't want to say who she wakes up next to, but she wakes up one morning having slept with someone for the first time. She really needs the loo, but she's just like, oh God, I can't because my bathroom's there. And what if I get up and I make a noise or like a smell? And oh my God, what would happen? And so she lies there having this like ridiculous internal monologue for about 20 minutes. And then she sort of inches out just as he wakes up and sort of reaches for her. She's like, oh, for Christ's sake, well, now I can't, can I? And it's that thing that, you know, girlfriends and I have spent many a time debating about, like, you know, when you first go away with someone or you go on holiday with someone.
Oh,
like,
I can...
I'm going to be internally damaged.
No. Okay, so have you had a poo-pourri?
Yeah, is it the Aesop
the spray.
Drops? Oh no, they're Aesop. So they're like very posh Aesop drops. Actually, my boyfriend has hilariously.
So I got sent. This is even funnier. I thought I was going to go and date this guy, and then he cancelled on me. And I got sent this delivery thing, and I for some reason thought it was flowers. It was in a quite nice box. So I started an Instagram story to show off that I've been sent flowers by this boy. Then opened it, and it was like, I was like, what's that little sprays? I was like, what does it say? And then I looked at the thing, and I was like, poo-pourri, pooper, and it was like spray in the loo before you go poo. And I was like, what?
Interesting. Okay.
And then I was doing all of this on my Instagram story. It's so embarrassing. And I realised it was like a PR package.
You saved it. It's one of your saved stories. It 100% should be.
So funny. But then it's actually amazing. So you spray it in the toilet bowl.
Yeah.
And you just get that smell no matter what happens.
Really? Yeah. And is it a nice, like, you know how summer sprays?
You can get lemongrass. And it just goes in the loo. And it doesn't.
I'm going to Google it immediately.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. It's really good.
Just, oh God, that hideousness.
So we can,
I mean, even though I've been going out with my boyfriend for over a year now, I mean, it's still one of those topics you're just a bit like, oh,
I actually just think you don't need to. I think even if it happens, you should just not acknowledge it. Don't talk about it. Just ignore it.
Or I think sometimes go the other way and they're like, we just really discuss it.
I think it's too far. I think that's weird.
Yeah, my brother has strong feelings about it. He thinks you never, ever, ever talk about it.
I just think it's unnecessary. And I also think because it can be, you know, you sometimes want to say it because you think it makes it less embarrassing.
Yeah.
I actually sometimes think that just don't call it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I've done that before when I'm like, have you farted? And then I feel a bit bad because I'm like, I could have just not. Like, it's clear they have.
Yeah.
You just...
We don't have to talk about everything.
Yeah, just ignore it. It's like they probably didn't mean to do that, did they? They just leave it.
Oh, hideous.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we got down to the bottom of it, quite literally. Yeah. Well, it's been fab speaking to you.
You too.
Thank you so much for coming on. I hope that this made sense. I don't even know if I asked you any of the right questions.
I loved it though, just, you know, yeah, general gossip.
Chat. Yeah, it's fab. Thank you so much. People want to find you online.
Online, I'm Sophia M. Coots on Instagram and Twitter, or I've got my website, sophiamoneycoots.com.
Okay, fab. Book will be available.
A book's out the 9th. It's, the Plus One out on the 9th on Kindle, on audio, which I recording the sex scenes was really cringe. And hardback out, next week.
Thanks. Bye.